On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I am Manpreet Nand, your moderator. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest. The Honorable Joe Oliver was elected to the House of Commons for the first time in 2011 and was appointed the Minister of Natural Resources on May 18th of this year. Prior to his election to Parliament, Mr. Oliver had a career in the investment banking industry. He began his career at Merrill Lynch and served in senior positions at other investment dealers, including as the Executive Director of the Ontario Securities Commission. He was then appointed President and Chief Executive Officer of the Investment Dealers Association of Canada. Mr. Oliver obtained both his Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Civil Law at McGill University before his receiving his MBA from the Harvard Graduate School of Business. He's also extensively traveled throughout the U.S. Here to discuss the U.S. and Canadian Energy Partnership, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Minister Joe Oliver.
Thank you very much, Manpreet, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For the past few days, I've been at APEC Energy and Transportation Conference on the Asia-Pacific region. I also met legislators, think tanks, and business people. Canada is very keen to showcase its energy products for this huge emerging market, and that's why I'm talking to my counterparts in key markets. But I believe it's even more important to deepen long-standing relationships like that Canada has with the United States. Canada and the U.S. share the world's longest border, a rich history, a highly integrated economy, and common values. And all these factors, especially common values, are crucial to our highly successful relationship. So I'm delighted to be here to talk about Canada's energy relationship with America to the World Affairs Council. And I appreciate the opportunity to address this audience of informed and engaged people interested in public policy issues. And I commend the Council's focus over the decades on issues of international importance. And I salute your goal to not only deepen our common understanding of these issues, but to search for practical solutions. So my central message today is this: our energy relationship is an important engine driving the economies of our two great nations. And I believe that we can create even more jobs, stimulate even more growth, and further strengthen our energy security on both sides of the border. And I want to assure you that Canada will pursue these goals in an environmentally and socially responsible manner. So let me share some fundamentals about our trade relationship that may not be widely known. Just as the United States is Canada's most important market for exports, America sells more to Canada than you do to Japan or Mexico or China or all the countries of the European Union combined. Every day, thanks to the North American Free Trade Agreement and our strong bilateral relationship, our countries send more than $1.5 billion of goods and services across the border every single day. And this impressive amount of trade keeps 8 million Americans working. An important amount of this economic activity is right here in this state. And small wonder, when you consider how much Canada and California have in common, the minor differences in our climate notwithstanding. We have a similar population size, skilled workers, world-class education, and the curiosity and talent to develop smart technologies. Indeed, we collaborate on cutting-edge R&D through mechanisms like the Canada-California Strategic Innovation Partnership. For these reasons, we're able to leverage our comparative advantages and generate wealth on both sides of the border. At last count, two-way trade between Canada and California surpassed $28 billion, and that makes us one of your biggest trading partners, and it creates more than 930,000 jobs in the Golden State. Our trade in energy is an important part of the mix. Canada provides 19% of California's natural gas, about 7% of its crude oil. And our scientists are working together on clean energy solutions that reduce our collective greenhouse gas emissions. So when I look to Canada's future and see the phenomenal energy resources we're developing, I think our country can play a much larger role in meeting the energy security needs of California, indeed the United States as a whole. So let me turn to how Canada's energy resources can provide both energy security and economic benefits to America. Let's start with a few facts. Canada is the world's sixth largest producer of oil, with proven reserves the third largest in the world. We're the third largest producer of both natural gas and hydroelectric power, and we're the second largest producer of uranium. Oil, gas, hydro, nuclear. These are the resources that help drive our economy, and they represent about 7% growing of our GDP. And these are the resources that have created hundreds of thousands of direct and indirect jobs across our country. And they are the resources that have sharpened our global competitiveness and secured our high standard of living. That said, we're also determined to bring new sources of clean energy into the mix. And after all, we have more than 5.5 million square miles of land, including more than 124,000 miles of coastland. So that makes us ideally suited to expand the use of renewable energy sources, everything from solar power to tidal energy, biofuels, and wind. Our government's investments have contributed to some truly innovative projects. For example, our Fundy Ocean Research Center for Energy will allow us to harness the power from the incredible tides in the Bay of Fundy on Canada's Atlantic coast, tides greater than all the rivers in the world. Since 2006, the government has invested more than $10 billion to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and build a more sustainable economy and environment. And this includes investments in green infrastructure, energy efficiency, clean energy technologies, and the production of cleaner energies and fuels. For Canada, energy efficiency is one of the fastest, greenest, and most cost-effective ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, save energy, and increase energy security. Apart from creating a greener environment for all Canadians, our investments are also creating green jobs. Canada is already one of the cleanest electricity systems in the world. More than 75% of our electricity comes from non-emitting sources, including 60% from hydro. Canada's existing hydroelectric capacity represents the largest clean and renewable power on the North American electricity grid. And last month, we proposed regulations to make our electricity system even cleaner. And over the next few years, we will phase out traditional coal units and encourage investments in cleaner technologies. We all want low-carbon technologies to play a more dominant role in the global energy mix, and we are moving towards that goal. But in the meantime, we have to be honest about this, global oil demand is expected to grow by 36% between now and 2035, according to the International Energy Association. 20 years from now, even under the most optimistic scenario for alternatives, fossil fuels will still be needed to meet almost 70% of world energy demand, according to the International Energy Agency. So oil is here to stay for the foreseeable future. We cannot ignore that fact. Our challenge, then, is to develop oil resources to meet growing demand and to do so in a socially and environmentally responsible manner. As I said a few minutes ago, Canada is blessed with the third largest proven oil reserves in the world. 170 billion barrels, or more than 97%, are in the oil sands of Western Canada. And as technology evolves, and the oil sands are basically a technology product, these reserves could grow to as high as 315 billion barrels. So when you consider that close to 1,000 American companies from virtually every sector are already supply the oil sands, you can imagine the ripple effect on the U.S. economy. Here in California, for example, 73 companies are supplying everything from industrial welding machinery and valves used in pipelines, to software and corrosion monitoring systems. Apart from their economic impact, the oil sands stand to make a huge difference to U.S. energy security, given the overarching fact that America is heavily reliant on imported oil. Compared to the U.S., Canada holds more than 8 times the volume of proven oil reserves. That's 8 times. As a result, nearly 1/4 of U.S. oil imports, about 2.5 million barrels per day, already come from Canada. Put another way, Canadian oil is fueling 1 in 8 cars on U.S. roads. So that makes us your biggest supplier of crude oil and petroleum products. Beyond that, Canada is by far the largest supplier of all your energy needs. And crucially, we are also your most reliable supplier. If you look around the world, 80% of known oil reserves are state-controlled or managed by national oil companies. That is not the case in Canada. According to a recent study for the U.S. Department of Energy, by 2030, America can substantially reduce its dependence on oil from foreign suppliers in the Middle East and Africa. How? By continuing to improve fuel efficiency and importing more oil from Canada. Canada has always been a secure and reliable supplier of oil, and we will continue to be. Ladies and gentlemen, the best way to build America's energy security is to look north. Canada will deliver the oil, and the U.S. can reap the economic benefits. We will as well, of course. But to achieve this mutually advantageous goal, we need major investments in oil infrastructure. And that's why Canada is investing in the oil sands, and that's why we strongly support the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. In the next 25 years, oil sands development will support, on average, an estimated 93,000 jobs per year in the United States. And if the Keystone XL project gets approved, U.S. employment will be forecasted to grow to 160,000 jobs a year. And I don't have to dwell on the importance of generating employment in the current economic environment. During the same 25-year period, it's estimated that oil sands development will pump an average of $8.4 billion per year into the U.S. economy. If Keystone is approved, you can expect that to grow to $14.4 billion a year. Now, to put it mildly, the Keystone XL pipeline has received a lot of attention lately. And it seems that every week the police are hauling off another celebrity to jail. So let me try to set the record straight about the Keystone XL project. First fact, pipelines are recognized as the safest way to transport large volumes of crude oil or petroleum products. Indeed, the recently released State Department final environmental impact statement on the project said, and here I'm quoting, the project would have a degree of safety greater than any typically constructed domestic pipeline system, better than the existing pipelines in the United States. The EIS is really a key step in the approval process. The Government of Canada believes that the project is an important plank in building continental energy security, creating jobs, and generating economic activity. But of course, we respect the American permit process and we look forward to a final decision, which is expected by year end. Canada also has stringent regulations on energy development, and as I speak, an independent panel is examining the merits of the Northern Gateway Pipeline project, which would open access to the Asia-Pacific Rim for Canadian oil producers. As part of its mandate, the panel will examine the impact of the proposed pipeline on the rights and interests of Aboriginal peoples. And that's another aspect of Canada's commitment to environmentally and socially responsible energy development. Still, like the Keystone project, there are some misconceptions about the environmental impact of the oil sands, so I'd like to try to clear them up. First is the impact on land from surface mining. Companies are now required by law to remediate and reclaim 100% of affected land. And that land, by the way, only constitutes 1/1000th of our boreal forests. In this way, the land is then able, after being reclaimed, to sustain vegetation and wildlife as it had before. Last July, I visited a boreal forest in Alberta that had been remediated, and I can tell you, you would never know that there was once a mine site there. Second, there's the impact on water. Most water used in oil sands development is recycled, up to 85% for mining and up to 90% for drilled or in situ projects. Yes, water is needed to make up for water losses. Mining operations require 3 or 4 barrels of new water to produce a barrel of oil. However, in situ projects, and that represents 80% of the extraction process, they only require a single barrel of oil to produce 1 barrel of crude. No water used in oil sands production is returned to the river. Rather, it's transferred to tailing ponds and then recycled into the production process. Now finally, let me say a few words about the important subject of greenhouse gas emissions. Canada is committed to reducing its total emissions by 17% from 2005 to 2020, which is identical to the commitment made here in the United States. And I said earlier, we're investing billions of dollars to help reach that target. Now, few people know that oil sands account for 0.1% or 1 in 1,000 of global emissions. Electricity plants powered by coal in Wisconsin generate the same emissions as Canada's oil sands. Texas generates 3 times as much. And closer to home, you should know that on a per barrel basis, California heavy crude emits more GHGs than the average oil sand crude. So to single out the oil sands for special attack is inaccurate, unfair, and misleading. Since 1990, the industry has reduced emissions per barrel by 30%, and our investments in new technology are striving to make those numbers even better. Recently, the governments of Canada and Alberta committed to investing with Shell on a carbon capture and storage system. And that was done in one of the plants in Alberta, and that will help reduce emissions by 40%. Of course, we also work with our closest neighbors to address climate change. And over the past 2 years, Canada and the U.S. have embarked on a clean energy dialogue. This process has deepened our existing collaboration on innovative clean energy technologies, and we're seeing solid advances in important areas such as carbon capture and storage, smart grid technologies, and energy efficiency. And I'm working with Secretary Chu, who's the Energy Secretary, to advance the second phase of the dialogue. This kind of bilateral dialogue makes a lot of sense given the highly integrated nature of the North American economy, especially in the transportation sector. And that's why we work closely together to set common standards for emissions for new light-duty vehicles. And we're building on this success to do the same for heavy-duty vehicles. In short, Canada is committed to develop its energy resources, including the oil sands, in a socially and environmentally responsible way. We're proud to collaborate whenever possible with our American friends. The importance of working together on energy issues is recognized on both sides of the border. A recent poll that was conducted, just last month, found that almost 9 out of 10 Americans and 8 out of 10 Canadians see developing an integrated energy policy as important. Views of this kind have remained strong and relatively unchanged for quite some period of time. So, ladies and gentlemen, there are 2 undeniable facts about our energy relationship. America will need oil in the years ahead. Canada has oil and can meet your growing needs in a secure and reliable way. Oil is an inevitable part of our energy future, so we must continue to develop existing energy resources. I believe the abundant resources in Canada's oil sands are North America's best energy investment. In the coming years, we can together create even more jobs, propel even more economic growth, and strengthen our energy security on both sides of the border. Thank you, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. I've gotten quite a few questions here during the time that you were giving your opening remarks, and perhaps I'll start off with a topic which you rightly recognize has been in the news a lot lately, which is the oil sands issue and the Keystone XL pipeline in particular. And I gather from your remarks, you commented upon how there are different points of view on this. I think many people view this pipeline issue as being a proxy for climate change efforts generally. Some view it being a more than just a proxy, but a great detriment to our mitigation efforts. And others, and I think you would fall more into this category, really see this as a much more pragmatic endeavor, one that may marginally affect greenhouse gas emissions, but at the end of the day, provide great economic and energy security benefits. Some of the questions that have come in fall along the following lines, and you addressed a little bit of this, but maybe you can expound a little bit, is specifically on the local environmental challenges of developing oil sands. You talked about water and some of the others. There was a question on forest burning coming from the Natural Resources Ministry. If you could comment on how development of oil sands might affect forestry in Canada and what that might mean. And another somewhat unrelated question, but perhaps one that needs a little bit of explanation. Why doesn't Canada just refine the oil themselves? Why does this resource need to be transported across the U.S.? Why can't you just refine it yourselves and then sell the fuel?
Well, let me just deal with the last point first, if I can. Sure, we could refine it in Canada, but of course it would have there's no difference in global greenhouse emissions whether we refine it or you refine it, you get more economic benefit obviously if you refine it than if we refine it. And we'd still have to get it down to you, so we'd still have to build a pipeline. So I don't see that it has any material impact at all, other than the fact that the current system generates more jobs for America and more growth for your economy. In terms of forestry, as I said, all the forests will be remediated and brought back to their original state, and in fact, that's what's happening as we speak. As I mentioned, I was up there, and what happens once they complete the extraction in a particular area and move on, the remediation starts immediately. Just to explain the technology a little bit, 80% of the extraction is referred to as in situ, and what that really is just drilling a hole and injecting steam, turning the bitumen into liquid form to get it out, and so there's less impact on the land, much less. If the oil is found, I think at about 80 feet or less below the surface, that isn't practical because injecting steam would result in the land collapsing. So that has to be extracted through open pit mining, which is 20% of it. But you know, all that is brought back to its original state. I mean, I was up there, and I can tell you, it's pretty huge. But it's still, you know, a very small part of our forest. I said it's, you know, 1/1000th of the forest, and it all will be brought back. I mean, the land is taken away when the mining occurs, and then it's brought back, and there's cover, and you know, none of the land really was habitable, so no one. You know, no communities were disrupted, but a lot of employment is generated in that area, which is, you know, fairly far north, well north of Edmonton, and there's been a tremendously positive impact on Aboriginal communities, some of which, you know, suffer from high unemployment and now are very gainfully involved, and so there's a high percentage of Aboriginals involved in the projects, and some as equity partners. Some of the tribes are brought in as equity partners if they're close, and people are employed. So it's having a very positive impact on the local economy and the environmental issues I've sort of addressed.
Could you talk a little bit about the Asian investment in Canada for oil sands? We've seen in particular the Chinese national oil companies and even the Sovereign Wealth Fund very interested in investing in oil sands and perhaps infrastructure, obviously with exports in mind. Do you see any conflicts of interest that might come about? You talked a lot about energy security, cooperation between Canada and the U.S. being for the benefit of the U.S. Do you foresee any circumstances, and if so, what could be those circumstances where there might be conflicts with that type of investment coming into Canada?
Well, there's sort of two aspects. One is Chinese companies or state-owned companies investing in Canada, and the other aspect really is the export of oil to Asia, including China. Just on the first point, we have legislation that deals with that issue. Foreign acquisitions have to meet a national interest test, a net benefit test in terms of the national interest, and it would each be analyzed in that way. So, you know, I can't comment on what the precise reaction to a particular investment would be. That's not my portfolio, and that has to be looked at on the facts. But you know, as I said, a very large portion of the investable resources are located in Canada, and there's therefore a keen interest in the part of a number of companies to invest in our resources. So, you know, we expect to see that as a continuing issue. I think I'd mentioned that the United States represents 97% of our exports. So essentially, we have one customer. It's a great customer, but anyone in business will tell you there's a certain vulnerability to rely on one customer, particularly when you have a product which that customer doesn't have the capacity to absorb. So it's a matter of important strategic interest for Canada to also look to Asia to export its resources. And as I mentioned, there's another major project which is undergoing a regulatory review right now. The review probably won't be completed for another year. And if it's positive, then that would allow us to move the oil sands from Alberta to British, to the coast of British Columbia, and then on by tanker to Asia. Mm-hmm. So that's an important strategic objective for our country.
Mm-hmm. If we could shift a little bit to a little bit even further north, the Arctic.
Sure.
There's been a great deal said of late with regards to how Canada sees development in the Arctic. I believe that's part of your ministry's portfolio as well, Arctic research. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about perhaps some of the risks and maybe even opportunities, depending on how you see it, of the changing climate and how that's affecting the Arctic? You know, there some see it as a major danger. You know, with climate change, there's major ecological impacts. Some see it as opportunities, easier navigation, easier to explore and produce. How do you see it?
Sure. Before I answer that, I just want to pick up one other point that I neglected to mention. When you look at this, the oil sands and this particular project. There's a sense that if the oil didn't come in from Canada, that would be the end of the oil. But of course, that's not what would happen at all. The oil would come in from Venezuela or from Saudi Arabia, and we would be shipping more oil out. So you got to take into account. The ecological impact of the oil coming in and a tanker traffic is more dangerous than pipelines. And you have to take into account the greenhouse emissions from the tankers coming in from the Middle East to the United States, and the greenhouse emissions from the tankers moving from British Columbia to Asia. So when you add all that, it really equalizes the greenhouse emissions pretty much. So to the Arctic, I was up there fairly recently with the Prime Minister, who does an annual Arctic tour, and we went up to Resolute Bay, which is in the Arctic Circle, and Baker Lake. You know, part of the reason, quite frankly, it relates to sovereignty. You have to have a presence up there. Part of it relates to reaching out and developing programs for indigenous communities who are, you know, fairly isolated and need some assistance and economic development so they can stand on their own. And a part of it relates to the type of economic development that that our natural resources will likely produce. You know, every country has the right to natural resources 200 miles beyond its shore, 200 nautical miles beyond its shore. That's what the law of sea provides. And then as far as the continental shelf extends beyond that. So we're going to be, you know, doing surveys to determine how far the continental shelf extends. The continental shelf doesn't extend very far in the Pacific, but it does on the Atlantic side, and it does in the north. So we are aware that there are potentially tremendous resources up there. Other countries are as well. With climate change, it is likely that there'll be more accessibility, and it's very important that the vulnerability, the ecological vulnerability, be addressed, because of the difficulty, the extraordinarily harsh conditions up there. The number of months in the year in which oil could be extracted, or in the event of some kind of a spill, can be remediated, are fairly short. And so those are some of the issues which regulatory bodies will have to look at. And we are, you know, this everything we do in terms of oil sands development or mining has to be vetted by an independent regulatory body first, just like it is in the United States. And so we have our regulatory bodies that will be looking at that, and if it passes muster, but only if it passes muster, we'll then be able to move ahead. So I see that as an area of increased interest on our part of the United States. Russia, Denmark has an interest from you know, and so on. So there'll be some attention paid, and so the North will become increasingly a top of mind in the decades ahead.
We're running short of time, so maybe I'll ask the final question and end it where you started in your remarks, and that's really around jobs and the economy. Given your prior experience in the private sector, maybe you could talk a little bit more about not just the effects of a good energy policy or strategy on jobs and the economy, but maybe some lessons learned. You know, Canada is fortunate in actually having a strategic energy policy. I think it's called energy, becoming an energy superpower is what I understand. In the United States, we're still in search of a cohesive energy policy. Are there lessons learned for your neighbors here in the South? Are there things that you would want to see us do? Are there ways that we could work together on a broader, more strategic level?
I won't pretend that we have a fully integrated energy policy. In fact, you know, our countries differ a little bit in terms of how much jurisdiction is attributable to the provinces or states. You know, and in Canada, it wasn't that way at the beginning, but it sort of crossed over, and our provinces have a bigger share of jurisdiction than your states do in terms of the ownership of natural resources. So, you know, everything we do has to be on a collaborative basis, and it can sometimes take quite a bit of time and a great deal of effort. I'm not here to tell the United States how to conduct its affairs. But I am here to say that we're a willing partner to work with the U.S. government on a lot of things that are important to both our countries and that are based on values, common values that we hold dear. We both want to see energy developed in a sustainable way for our children and our grandchildren, and some of the technological developments, of course, are not proprietary to just our country. They're you know, they can be of benefit to yours and of course vice versa. So, you know, I think it's really important that we advance the clean energy dialogue that we have with the United States, that we work together on technological development. I was just in San Jose, you know, just a little while ago, talking to a group of Canadian entrepreneurs. We have an accelerator program that provides access and networking for these you know expats who are working with American venture capitalists here. We're working on carbon capture and storage, you know our economies are incredibly integrated. I mean one fact that I hadn't known I found really quite remarkable. You know, given our tremendous trade, you know, as I said, it's $1.6 billion every day. 1/3 of that trade is within the same company. That is to say, a company operating on both sides of the border is trading with, you know, to pick an example, an American company, you know, General Motors is you know through the our auto pack is you know. Cars are built in Canada, and a lot of them are exported to the U.S., and, of course, cars built in the United States are exported to Canada. So that would be one example of that sort of thing. So there's a tremendous amount of integration in our economies, and so really, you know, we really have to work together, and, you know, we're willing partners, and the relationship has been a great one. It certainly transcends party politics, and it looks to be, frankly, increasingly important over time.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council, thank you so much, Minister Oliver, for providing us with your thoughts and insights. Safe travels back home, and thank you.
Thank you
Good
very
night.
Much.